Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
This is Dumpty Dum, sponsored by managers.
Woof. Hello, everybody. I am beside myself with excitement because not only are we resurrecting the Zooms, the Dumpty Dum Zooms, but we have a proper guest of honour. Charlotte Higgins, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm super sorry for being late to this amazing party. I have to admit that I'm slightly... flexibly working. What I'm trying to say is that this is a working day for me, and I'm just skipping out for a few minutes to speak to you guys. I'm slightly guilty, which is why I was late, because I was sort of embroiled.
Well, listen, no worries.
So very nice to see you all.
Listen, utterly no worries. What we did was we were just going around having a little bit of a chat, just saying later, everybody seeing where they were. And actually, we a couple of years ago, at the height of COVID, we made a real thing of this on a Friday. Instead of having the pleasure of listening to the Archers on a Friday, we did this kind of every week. We had all manner of actors on the show, and it was a wonderful thing. So I didn't think that anybody would actually turn up, but we do have 17 of us on this Zoom call, and we have even more actually on YouTube. So we have a right royal smorgasbord of Archers fanatics who've come to ask you some hard questions, Charlotte Higgins. So I hope you've got some in-depth answers for us.
I'll do my best. Very much admired your pronunciation of smorgasbord there.
Oh, no. I grew up in Stockholm, so the outside of Stockholm pronunciation of smorgasbord.
Very good.
First off, you have taken over the mantle of this monthly Guardian Archers column from a legend. How's it feel a year plus in? Are you filling her shoes adequately, or do you feel like, woof, you know, these are some big shoes to fill?
No one's ever going to fill Nancy Banksmith's shoes adequately. And there are moments where I think, why did I do that? Because I did it on an absolute whim, actually. I suggested it because, as you know, Royfield, because I interviewed you for it, I wrote a big piece for The Guardian, like a 5,000-word piece on the Archers and its cultural significance that went that was timed to the Archers' 70th birthday. And it was after that I felt like, you know, I've been a lifelong listener to the Archers. I've accumulated quite a lot of knowledge about the way the Archers is made. My obsession with the Archers is not only undiminished, but probably fueled by this experience. So on a complete whim, one day I just emailed the radio and TV editor at The Guardian and said, how about I do a month in Ambridge? And I did not think that's a really stupid thing to do, because, like, basically one of the three greatest writers The Guardian has ever employed invented that slot. So it was a really stupid thing to do. Anyway, also when you fire off these emails, you actually expect them to be greeted by infinite silence. But in this case, I got a really quick response. That's a great idea. Let me just discuss it with blah. And then within a day or so, I got the gig. And then I thought, gosh, I've got to do it. And then I thought, gosh, Nancy. So I wrote Nancy. I wrote Nancy an email. And I think the commissioning editor also wrote to Nancy. You know, obviously we wanted to be sure that Nancy herself was okay with this. And I got the most incredible email back from Nancy, which was, something to cut out and keep. And it was not only was it incredibly encouraging, but also it was written in pure Nancy Banks Smith best prose, and just said, you know, you should do it. Please yourself. No one else is going to do it for you. You know, just do it. And, you know, and she just gave me a shot to the arm, and I thought, well, if Nancy thinks it's okay, then it's okay. So I did it. But I think, in answer to your question about how does it feel a year and a bit on, I think it feels like I'm finding my way of doing it, which obviously is not the same as, or, you know, as good as Nancy. But the one thing, I try not to look back at Nancy's old columns now, because I did read them all when I wrote my enormous piece about the Archers, but I don't look at them now and kind of weep with despair. But I do feel that the big thing that I take on from the way she did it is that just to pretend that it's real, you know, just to treat the characters as if they're real, never to talk about the acting or the direction or the spot effects or the actors as such, or to talk about the script writers or the plot lines, just to treat it as if it's kind of reality radio. And I think that's such a nice way of handling it. It's such a fun way of doing it. And I see absolutely no reason to do it any differently. I think that was a sort of brilliant ploy of Nancy's, which I'm happy to carry on with. It makes it a lot of fun to write.
Why do you think that this column is essential Guardian reading? You know, if you were to lay out all of the UK broadsheets, I'd have thought this would have sat in the Telegraph or the Express as opposed to the Guardian. Why do you think it's become such a staple of the Guardian?
I don't know. I think it probably is Nancy. And I don't actually know the origin of it. I think it was when Nancy was winding down from other responsibilities, but this was a kind of lovely thing to do. And it was a monthly thing. But I mean, sometimes I think it's quite nice when The Guardian does something that doesn't feel terribly Guardian-ish. And sometimes those are the best things in The Guardian, when it's running slightly counterintuitive. That said, I mean, there are tons of, you know, this column gets quite good numbers, given that it's about a single radio program on a single network that we know that quite a lot of people really hate. People do read it.
I beg your pardon.
That's got its audience.
I beg your pardon.
Well, sometimes you kind of, well, you know, I mean, unduly pessimistic because, you know, why would anyone read my stupid column about the Archers? But yeah, I mean, it does surprisingly well to me anyway, in terms of numbers of people who kind of read it. So clearly that there are a lot of Guardian reading Archers listeners. And, you know, in a way, why wouldn't there be? We're all listening, you know, Guardian readers, Radio 4 listeners, quite a big crossover there, you know, the middle classes. Why pretend otherwise?
How have you found the rabid partisan nature of Archer's fandom? Because, you know, a lot of us do believe that this is our version of the Archers. And we can be quite vociferous about other people's interpretations or the script writers or some of the actors and whatever. So, you know, some of us can be a little bit of a vicious bunch. How have you dealt with that, with people saying, oh, you're no Nancy Banks Smith or whatever, or, you know, or what you said last week in your column, I completely disagree with.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a journalist for 25 years and you kind of get to the point where you take that stuff on the chin, you know. And I'm well aware, you know, I also feel very strongly about certain things in the Archers. I understand that people have very strong feelings. And, you know, I've dipped in and out of the Facebook groups and I know the sort of things that people say. And I just think this is completely brilliant because people are so creative and so interesting in what they in what they pick out of the storyline. And the kind of analysis they have of different. I mean, there's a certain amount of rough and tumble. Let's say, as you say, passions can rise quite fiercely. But in general, I'm amazed at the sort of perspicacity that people bring to bear on what is, after all, only a soap opera.
Not really. It's the soap, the oldest in the world. It's the soap.
Yeah.
One of the things which I really wanted to talk to you about is what I kind of perceive to be this kind of passing of the baton. It seems to me that in the last year, we have a whole load of younger characters. And what's really significant for me is that these aren't necessarily solid middle-class Waitrose sandwich eating young folk. You know, we have the Cases. Obviously, we have Brad and George now, etc. What says you, Charlotte, about this? All these new characters which have come in, which a lot of them don't even have, receiver of fancy Asian accents. You know, the Cases are at Brumming Me even.
The Case. I know. It's good. I think it's good. Is it good? I don't know. I mean, in a way, part of the joy of the Nancy Banks Smith technique, let's call it, is it's just accepting what comes in a way and not being heavily critical, oddly, if you can understand that. So I don't have kind of strong prescriptions in my mind about what the script writers should or shouldn't do. In a way, I just kind of, I'm fascinated by it and, you know, kind of accept what comes. I do think the rise of the House of Horobin is, you know, clearly the big, big slow burn arc. And I'm quite interested in that the idea that what for most of my lifetime were the unspeakable, you know, you could not, the Horobins were unspeakable. As a family clan, they were the lowest of the low. They were the lumpen proletariat, basically, of Ambridge, and their rise to prominence it amuses me greatly. I kind of revel in this. Actually, I know there are lots of people who feel like if I never heard from another Horobin, that would be fine. You know, this is all a bit ridiculous, but I quite like this slow motion Marxist revolution, and I quite like the way the rise of the Horobins, at least in it seems to have softened a bit in the last month or so, but at least for a time seemed to be being balanced by the absolute cataclysmic fall of the House of
Aldridge.
Aldridge, exactly. But then, like, they seem to have pulled themselves back from the brink, sadly. I'm kind of into the I'm into George and Brad. I thought I was really properly gripped by the George and Brad interchanges while they were haymaking. Because I thought, actually, yeah, we sort of need an unpleasantly manipulative, nasty character who's just going to chuck a spanner into the works, and, you know, really kind of mess things up a bit for people. And I thought, yeah, bring it, George, you horrible little piece of work.
Well, you know, absolutely. And considering that I always say that I love episodes of The Archers when nothing happens. Just give me people just talking about nothing and I'm just happy for 12 minutes. The more I sit down and realize it, that actually it always does need a villain, doesn't it? It does need a Matt Crawford or a Greg or just someone who's just thoroughly unpleasant. And it seems to help kind of crystallize things. You know, we do need a baddie. And to start off with a baddie so young, I think is kind of unprecedented, really. Generally, the baddies float in fully formed as a bit of a wrong one, like a Matt Crawford.
Suppose you've got Roy, you've got racist Roy. And usually, I suppose, in my mind, I think, well, you know, in The Archers, usually these bad characters are at least halfway redeemed. So, you know, is George going to have a rather tedious arc of, you know, becoming a nice person in about 5 years' time? Who knows? I mean, no, I can see some shakings of the head from fellow participants in the session. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I do think also the Horribins for me is giving us some really, I mean, maybe a lot of us don't want to think about the cost of living crisis on The Archers because we've got enough of it in our own lives. Thank you very much. However, I do think from the point of view of actually engaging in at least lightly in the real world, it is kind of, I quite like it this is getting horribly real for Tracy, and the cost of living crisis is being reflected in even in the southern uplands of Lakey Hill.
Absolutely. And I don't know whether this was, whether obviously, because the Horribins, as you rightly say, were always the lowest of the low, you know, much lower than the Grundys. The Grundys looked down at the Horribins, and hence one of Susan's kind of story arcs was always the fact that she tried to distance herself away from a Horribin forebears and a wider family. How do you think that let's say the cases, I know you said you're kind of just living in the moment type of thing, but there has to be some direction for the cases. What do you think that possibly might actually be?
Yeah, it's extremely hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, they're just floating around becoming, I mean, it seems a bit trivial at the moment, doesn't it? That this kind of minor plot line about the Seth Best Ben thing. Sorry, I always have to include Bess in this because,
well, I did like that line, that
all the same sounding name, it's ridiculous. Beth, Ben, Bess and Seth. In fact, to the extent that when I first wrote about these Casey girls, I got them mixed up and I had to run a wretched correction in the paper because I'd misheard Steph or Beth, or, you know, annoying me greatly. Yeah, it's I'm finding it hard to figure out what function they're going to provide long term. I mean, I do think, you know, Vince is a sort of self-made entrepreneur, I suppose. You know, the whole the abattoir's he's a Brummie, yeah. Which, of course, you know, I think that is, as you say, that's really important. The Archers is made in Birmingham, and, you know, please can we have a proper Brummie character? Yes, here's a proper Brummie character. The abattoir, of course, is quite an, you know, it's an interesting fact of farming life. I thought Vince showed promise at one point because he was so interested in art. And I thought, oh my goodness, maybe Vince is like a secret aesthete and incredible art collector. Do you remember? I mean, it was ages ago now, but he and Russ had a kind of moment in the putative, I think, art gallery in Lower Loxley and
Basquiat. Yes, they were talking. And he knew Basquiat.
He had views. He had interesting sounding views on art. This hasn't been picked up at all. I don't know. What do you think? I just feel that they're sort of bumbling around. And it was, you know, again, the sort of idea that Vince might be a badder, but he was sort of softened into actually, you know, a bit of a rough diamond, but actually, you know, he's made lots of mistakes in his life, has spoiled his daughters, thinks that problems can be solved with money. But actually, deep down, he's a bit of a sweetie, and it's all and you know, he's no Nigel, but kind of thing. It'll make him happy,
I just thought. Well, when he first came in, well, this is very obviously Jack Woolley Mark too. The fact that and obviously he's been an enabler for his one daughter in terms of a bad behavior. But he did turn around 2-3 weeks ago, didn't he, and actually say, no, I'm going to stop indulging you, etc. But I think it was really interesting when you speak to people like Kerry Davis, you realise that when a new character comes into the Archers, for the most part, they have no idea where they're going to go. They just kind of make it up slightly as they go along. I think they set in place some level of parameters that they're going to interact with this person, that person. But then it depends very much on serendipity, but then also how well that actor actually does in that role. And they say, oh, we need more of them. Then they create the supporting cast, you know. And so Tracy Horobin coming in back into it, it was because of the popularity of Susie Reed's the actor, you know, because, you know, they didn't think they were going to build a whole family kind of around her, you know. That's just come over time because they need to cement her as an essential part of Ambridge. But right now we do have, and I keep saying this, but I'm so blooming heartened that we have so many of you on this, considering it's in the middle of the workday. You've had enough of me. You hear me on the podcast every week. So why don't we throw this open for questions? Quentin Rayner, you knew exactly where I was going with this. You were muted when I was in mid flow, knowing I was going to hand the mic over. So why don't you pose a question, Quentin? Go for it.
Hi there. Thanks for joining us this morning for your insight. I've got lots to ask you, actually, but I just want to pick up on the fact that you say that you just take it as real, and it's actually a real village with real characters. When you're writing your column, how on earth do you resist not putting the boots into some really stupid plot lines? Because, I mean, if you've read the tweet along, as you say, you read Facebook posts, it drives us nuts. And we've had a real gamut of them recently, haven't we? We've had, you know, the war story with Lillian, and we had the Easter Bunny that went on for far too long. And then we had Steph and that ridiculous party. And how do you resist not putting the boots in?
Quentin, there are ways of doing it. I feel that there are times when my irritation does show, but it shows through this kind of lens of as if it's real. I did once let slip actually and said it's been a really bad month or something, and I got actually readers didn't like that at all, and I thought, you know, I got sort of cross with it. And you know, let slip the kind of illusion that it was real slightly, and readers didn't like it. And I thought, no, okay, yeah. I didn't like it either. I didn't think it worked as well. So, but yes, I do, I do find ways of, I hope, showing my irritation. Yeah. I mean, as you say, I'm not sure the Archers is in its best phase at the moment, I have to say. You know, I'm not, I agree. I think there's been some pretty ropey stuff. And I'm probably more or less on the same page as you with some of those little plot lines. We hope for better days.
We do. But in that sense, do you think it's transitional? I mean, do you think these annoying plot lines, the introduction of a lot of young, you know, new characters who are young, do you think the editorial team is thinking we need to refresh, you know, June Spencer, Bessa Cotton Socks is 103, you know, they're all getting older, aren't they? Do you think we are in that transitional phase, and we're just going to have to get used to these new characters and just accommodate them bit by bit.
Yeah, I imagine so. I imagine so. I feel like we are in need of a good slow burn to the slightly nail bitey plot line. I mean, we've had the Chris and Alice plot has seems to have, and that is going to be an enormous disaster. Feels like it's sort of calming down now. The Grey Gables is hardly going to have us, switching on the radio with, with the whites of our eyes, chewing our nails, is it? Although it is sort of interesting. They seem to be turning it. I always thought they should turn it into the Pig. You know, I don't know. Have you ever, it's a kind of posh chain of hotels and country locations where they have.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I've been to one. I went to one the other day up in Harlan. Yes.
They have their own vegetable gardens, and they only source produce from a 25-mile radius. Very modern. I thought,
that's a really good idea. they're doing great business down here. I tell you, I'll give the floor to somebody else in a minute. But I presented Dumpty Dumper quite a while with Philippa Hall, and I have to ask you. I scripted a pull together of the week for each Dumpty Dum, and that was hard enough. Just subbing a whole week's worth of the Archers into a script. Now, how on earth do you go about subbing a month's worth into one column? How do you go about it?
Well, I have to say it's really changed my listening habits because I used to, in normal non-professional life, I would. I'd listen to the Archers, but I wasn't fanatically attached to listening to every single episode. So if I wasn't in at 7 p.m. Or I hadn't managed to catch the omnibus, if I missed the odd one, that was fine. That's the whole joy of the Archers, right? In fact years can elapse and you can still tap in. So missing the odd episode is never an issue. These days, of course, it really feels like I've got to be on top of every episode. I cannot miss a moment. I've become a person who I sort of dip in and out, and then the weekend before my deadline, I go on a long walk. I'll go on two long walks and listen to all the omnibus.
Yeah.
While I'm walking on my phone, if I hear something kind of funny or that I feel like I could run with or interest me, I just make a quick note on my phone and I do it like that. But I mean, my job is different from your job because when you were doing that, I felt that you had to cover the bases, whereas I don't really have to cover the bases. I get to pick out stuff that is interesting to me or particularly, it feels like there might be a couple of jokes in it.
So it's light touch across the whole terrain, isn't it?
I'm listening out for kind of moments where I think that's really great, or that's really funny, or that's really embarrassing.
But you have to get, you're right, Charlotte. You have to get it right because this lot know their arts, don't they?
Oh yes,
you can't get it wrong.
Yeah, and I do get it wrong. Of course, I get it wrong because my memory is fallible. There are things that I invented a car. I don't know why I did this really, but I invented a car for Jim. It just had passed me by that Jim owned a very famously important car. And of course, 27,000 Archers listeners wrote to me and said, how could you possibly not know that, Jim has this very important Riley? And so, correction. In fact,
I feel your pain. I've made mistakes as well. They tick you off very nicely, I found, though. It's all very polite.
It's lovely, and I'm a person who's very happy to be. I hate error, so I'm always the person who's much happier to get it corrected immediately than sort of. Drag around an error.
One more question. Do you agree with me that the definition of an Archer's listener, frankly, is somebody who spends 98% of their time tearing their hair out, is just absolutely infuriated and annoyed by this wretched program. But there's that 2%, the nuggets, that keeps you going. Do you think that is the definition of a true Archer's listener?
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up in my household, in the 80s in Stoke-on-Trent, the Archers represented a few minutes of calm when the family didn't have to have an argument with each other. Usually we listened to it while eating supper, so the sort of truce was called. But also a great feature, just my family were very anti Susan Carter, and so when there was they were all horrid. I mean, this is a kind of one step on from what you're saying. When Susan went to prison, my family were very angry with all the Archers fans who thought it was wrong that she should go to prison. And there was a sort of mini household crusade that the kiddie should be forthwith thrown away and that Susan should rot in prison. So, yes, this irritation takes many different strange forms as well. It's a lot of fun. I can see these great chat stuff on the chat that everyone's pointing out about Vince, quite rightly, that Vince was sort of introduced to be an irritant and a challenge to David, which, of course, is a strong point.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you, Charlotte. Thank you very much, Charlotte. Thank you.
Absolutely. Right. If you've got a question, now is the time to unmute. And whilst you're A, thinking of your question, B, struggling with the unmute function, there is a question which I have from R. Stephen Bowden, who is a good denizen of Dumdy Dum. His question, quite simply, Charlotte, is how comes your columns don't go up on the website as soon as other kind of feature pieces? Why does he have to wait days? Because he says it's frustrating him.
It's annoying, isn't it? It's to do with, and I'm no expert on this, but it is to do with the fact that The Guardian publishes a huge, 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 huge amount of material on a Saturday. And yet, Saturday is our lowest web reading day. And so, according to those people of my colleagues who know about this stuff, which is not me, it is sort of somehow better. Things get read more if the publication is staggered. And for that reason, it's the same. For example, this is the one I find especially annoying, is that the recipes aren't published online until the following week, which is annoying if I have forgotten to buy a paper but really want to know what Rachel Roddy has written about that week. So I share your feelings of frustration, and that is broadly the explanation. Please don't ask me to defend it, because I'm a mere onlooker in this. It's, as it were, not my decision.
Well, that completely pans out with podcast downloads, that you want to upload a podcast on a Sunday night so people listen to it actually on a Monday on their commute to work. That's a well-known thing. And when I used to run myvillage.com, web stats collapsed at the weekend. That actually it's kind of counterintuitive. You'd think that everybody surfs at the weekend, but actually they surf during work days and work hours and then at the early evening. But anyway, Mike Gunn, you're unmuted. You've held your finger up not once, but twice, sir. Ask your question.
Yeah. I'd like to put a point to Charlotte about The Guardian, which is that I see The Guardian as part of a natural constituency of listeners. When the message board was, the BBC set up its message board over 20 years ago, the first thing I'd say is that it was very funny. Everybody really found The Archers very amusing and funny and made lots of witty comments. But it also came out in the wider discussions that took place that about 90% of the people on the original message board were actually Guardian readers. It was possible that there was just, you know, a majority of Guardian readers and the other people were frightened to speak up and say they read other papers. But I think you can look at The Archers as a sort of rather amusing critique of British society. And I think that's why I think it works on that level a great deal of the time. The other point I would make is that it's about characters, that they bring in new characters, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And the type of character that they're actually lacking at present, which I think George may turn into, is the lovable rogue, the person who is basically a bit unscrupulous and dishonest. But you can't help liking them. I know that not everybody liked Walter Gabriel, or not everybody liked Joe Grundy. But for me, they're the really great characters that when they come on and they do something a bit dodgy, that's what I really enjoy. You know, the rest of the Archers and so on I could do without, but that's the bit which I really enjoy. I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
Yeah, I think that is a really that's a really terrific point. And to your first point, that's very interesting too. I also wonder about the crossover between people who were willing to use message boards in the sort of early days of message boards and Guardian readers, because I think Guardian readers somehow probably more tech savvy than Telegraph readers. It's, you know, slightly more urban media savvy, you know, the Guardian very early on its website, all of that. But yeah, point taken completely. That's really good to know. And the lovable rogue thing, yeah, I suppose when you put it in those terms, it does feel like that's quite the sort of George's character, if you put it like that, he becomes a chip off the old block, doesn't he, in a really interesting way.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I like it when you can feel the history and heritage of the Guardian sort of coming through into the present. And yeah, is he's going, because Eddie's not a lovable rogue anymore. He's just lovable, isn't he? He's sort of ceased, actually, he's become a rogue. But he definitely was in the 80s. As you say, his grandfather, George's great-grandfather, was certainly a roguish person. Someone saying, could George turn into a character like Jazza has become? It's true. It seems to me like the Archers does get tempted into softening its rogue. So Jazza was a bit rogue. Now Jazza is now like the moral core of the Archers in this highly unlikely way, along with the rest of the Horribin Jazza kind of confederation. But yeah, Pam on chat is saying there's a nastiness to George and no lovability. I do think that, but so far that I haven't seen much redeeming features. Setting fire to the post box, I have to admit, because I've been away and not listening every day, I'm relying on my massive catch up. So I haven't heard it. I haven't heard every single episode since the setting fire to the post box. Was that him being, presumably that was him, was it him?
Oh yes, well, it was
doing them a favor, or was there any lovability to setting fire?
It wasn't made absolutely explicit, but I think you join up the dots and you know it's too much of a coincidence that the thing caught fire and he was in the vicinity and so on, and he mentioned lighter fuel. So
Carrie found lighter fuel. She is,
yeah.
So I suppose the a charitable interpretation to that would be he had found a way of helping his of helping Clary and Susan out of the, this difficulty. Yeah. When Susan, it was an unbelievably stupid, actually, I thought, plot line that Susan would be kind of, you know, blackmailing, you know, the stalwart of the WI around. I mean, I just thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the thing is that destroying, you know, setting fire to Her Majesty's mail is obviously a crime. But it's not the worst crime in the world. You know, there are people who do much worse things, I think, and, you know, much worse crimes. So I regard that as, you know, kind of, I can tolerate that in a way.
Mm-hmm. Probably not. By the way, Peggy getting nasty with age is coming up on the chat, which I think is a brilliant point. Like, when is the village going to rise up against Peggy? You've just given me a wonderful, wonderful image of everybody, you know, with pitchforks. turning on this, you know, ancient woman and her evil cat. And she has just done a very unpleasant thing, it's true. What a ridiculous thing to do with a wretched stained glass window. Yeah. Honestly.
True that. Now, let's go on just for another 8 minutes, good people. So if you have a question within you, let the question be free. Put it out into the ether. Unmute yourself and go for it.
Hi, Charlotte. It's Lillian McCarthy here from Middlesbrough. Can you hear me?
I can. Hello there. Nice to meet you.
Hello there. Hi. I'm just wondering, I've got two questions for you, if I may. The first one was, getting back to Vince, I had a theory that the reason he was so desperate to lend that money to David and Ruth for the solar panels was because he knows that he has some sort of terminal illness and he's not going to be able to spend that money. What are your feelings about that?
My feelings are, whoa, that had never crossed my mind. That is so interesting. Let's wait and see what happens. Okay, yeah, I hadn't thought of that at all, Lillian. But
well, he was just so insistent. And what made me think about it was when David finally agreed to accept it was a great big hug, which seems quite extreme for such a kind of male man, if you like, as Vince, to actually give somebody a hug.
Yeah, but I bet it was one of those
if
big
if that makes
man,
any sense.
Like,
yeah. He's like, yeah.
Very
and then my other... Oh. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. And
okay.
Then my,
give time
sorry,
or time right, on that one. Yeah, I want to know.
Oh, sorry. Okay, my other question, and probably one that everybody's wanting to know, is are you finding it really annoying that they're not telling us who the new owner is of Grey Gables? And when they asked all the questions, they had the meeting, nobody actually ask that question, and you're not turning around and telling me that the people of Ambridge don't want to know. We think on our WhatsApp Sunday Archers group, we think it's Hazel.
Oh my God, that's so good. That's very clever. That's very clever. I personally think that's much more plausible than Vince has got a terminal illness. Although I'm ready to be proved wrong on that. That's so clever. You're absolutely right. And it is bizarre. I completely agree that it's totally bizarre and strange that this new owner thing is shrouded in secrecy and it's total nonsense. Yes, I like it.
Yeah.
What happens. Who else is alive? And Matt Crawford's
thank
still
you so
alive.
Much. For that.
It would also, you know, be a way of honouring Jack, wouldn't it? You know, her dad. You know, so it would make complete and utter sense.
Hasn't she got a terminal illness, though, or has she just got long COVID?
That question's aimed at me. It's aimed at the wrong person. Anybody feel free to unmute and answer that.
She wasn't very well, was she? But I think
yeah, it was long COVID.
Yeah, she's had COVID.
Okay, so she's not.
She came shuffling into Ambridge and had to be helped by Peggy and Kate, didn't she?
Right.
Although some people thought she was putting it on.
Yes.
five minutes, good people. So 5 minutes, get your questions in. It's not every day you have the Guardian's foremost Archers writer right in front of you, ready and primed.
Guardian Archers writer, I think the fine. So I'll take that. I am the foremost Guardian Archers.
You are the foremost. You are the foremost. Yeah.
I thought the foremost were a Merseyside pop group.
Absolutely. So what how long have you actually been working for The Guardian?
25 years. Since 1997, since just shortly after Tony Blair became Prime Minister. I know you wouldn't be able to believe it, would you? I was a child.
You were one of Blair's babes then, were you?
Please no.
And because I must admit, right, I just kind of know you from doing the article. Obviously, I did know you before, but like, what exactly is your role as a journalist at the Archers? Because you did a thing about the Commonwealth Games opening and stuff. Yeah, so, what, so, are you the cultural writer? You are, what exactly is your hat that you wear at the Guardian?
I'm the chief cultural writer. Mm-hmm. I do, but that doesn't mean that I have lots of other smaller culture writers working for me. I'm just, that's just my ridiculous
title. Are you
title.
The foremost culture writer then? Is that what you're saying?
No comment. I wouldn't ever describe it that way. But let's put it that way. I've got lots of amazing colleagues. I write a... I've just started writing a regular cultural column on the op-ed pages, of which you talk about a piece that I wrote about the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games 10 years on. That was one of those columns which has just started. I write features for the arts pages. I write book reviews. I perhaps most, you know, onerously in a way, I write articles for the long read section, which is so my big piece on the Archers. Was an article for the long read. So I write for different parts of the paper. Everything that I do is broadly about culture. I mean, culture taken in quite a broad sense, which is why I include things like the Olympics and quite a lot of, I mean, I bring sort of politics into things where it seems like a good idea, particularly on the op-ed pages.
How excited were you? Charlotte, how excited were you? How excited were you the other day when Susan made a reference to cancel culture? You must have fallen off your chair.
Yeah, it's quite funny, isn't it? When the sort of motifs of real contemporary life wander into the Archers. And part of me just wants to say, there's one place that I could really do without the culture wars, and that is Rich.
We've got a question here from Bob Flood. I noticed in the chats, picks up on a point some of us have been making. Do you believe the younger characters are attracting younger listeners to the Archers?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, how would that even work? Do you know what I mean? I mean,
you mean if they're not listening in the first place? Yeah.
Yes.
But actually, there are a lot.
The strong plot lines attract listeners to the Archers, actually, don't they? I mean, I think sort of Rob Hallen attracted listeners to the Archers, but I don't think the fact of having a 16. I mean, maybe if it's on in the background and you're a kid and you hear stuff like, you know, Brad's anxieties about going to university or having enough money or. You know, maybe that does. I mean, it's bound to have some effect, but I don't see it sort of revolutionising the listener base of the Archers anytime soon.
There was an article recently, you probably saw it. Jeremy Howe was quoted as saying that actually the demographic that's increasing in terms of Archers listenership are the younger audiences. And that's because it's tied into the whole podcast culture. And he called it the new rock and roll? The Archers is the new rock and roll. But the younger demographic, the sort of 28 to 35, is increasing.
Yeah. And as you say, that I'm sure that's to do with podcast culture. And it's a whole different world. It's a whole different world out there. And that's really great.
Yes.
Whether the Archers is the new rock and roll, Jeremy is a person who often speaks with gentle irony.
I think he was. But do you think these, just picking up on Bob's point, do you think these younger stories will retain those younger listeners who appear to be gravitating?
What I definitely think is that the Archers can only, that the Archers as a long form drama that exists in real time can only renew itself by renewing its characters and keeping this cycle in motion where, you know, people are born, people reach the age of 16 and miraculously start to speak. And people die, you know, because it's like life. So, yeah. You know, in that sense, it has to. And I like it. I suppose the one young character that I think has seriously gone off the rails through no fault of his own, but I do think is sort of rather oddly written at the moment, is Rory and his career as a, I mean, what? But, I mean, I do think that's seriously deranged, that this middle-aged executive would be wanting to pay Rory for, I mean, it's just, no.
For company, I think it is. It's for company, isn't it?
For company, I know, but I mean, I can think of, I've got a couple of, I mean, there are a couple of 18-year-old boys that I really, you know, friends with my children who I just think are absolutely spectacularly brilliant people. But, you know, would you really pay an 18-year-old to kind of accompany you to corporate events?
Yeah. And nobody asked any questions either. It's extraordinary.
Isn't it? Exactly.
How does she introduce him at these corporate events?
Maybe it's my nephew. Maybe it's like that. Maybe it's like a sort of, you right. know, Renaissance Pope.
You know, I said as much on Dumpty Dum a couple of months ago, and was derided on the Twitters. I was called ageist and all manner of things. If it was purely a traditional escort service, which he was providing, which was given a little bit of how's your father, well, then it makes complete and utter sense. He's a young man in the prime of his life and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it makes no sense for her to take him to corporate events as whatever the heck he is. But on the note, though, that you talked about the Archers renewing the cycle of life, you know, births, marriages, deaths and whatever, I think this recording has probably come to a fitting end as well. All right. So I'd like to thank you, Charlotte Higgins, for being with us. And we'll have to do this again. Can we do this again?
I'd absolutely love to. I'm only sorry that I was a little bit late coming on. But I would absolutely love to. It's been a real joy. Also, I can steal your ideas from my next column. Absolutely excellent. It's really nice to talk about the Archers, man. I don't talk about it with other people enough. This is great.
We'll do this a couple of times a year. You can come on here, pilfer all of our great insights, and then pass them off as your own.
Exactly, uncredited.
Everybody, thank you for, I was going to say, taking time out of your work day, but most of you said you retired anyway. No, there's Shanna shaking and saying, I don't work, you know. But it's really good to see so many of you. As I said at the start, you know, we haven't done this for quite some time. We're going to resurrect this, but maybe move it back to its traditional slot on a Friday, maybe doing it at 7:30 after the Archers. Do it once a month. It's just a great way for us all to get together, talk about the Archers with somebody who is kind of like key to the Archers, whether it's a writer like Charlotte or maybe one of the actors on the show. So on that note, I'm going to say tatty bye to Rarabit. And Charlotte, just tell us what you're actually working on at the moment. Tell us where people can find you on social media, etc. And then we'll properly say Arabidurch.
Okay, on Twitter, I'm at Chiggy. At the moment, I'm working on some very serious minded op-ed pieces about, you know, politics and arts funding and stuff like that. Yeah, serious.
Fab. All right. Well, there you go. Follow Chiggy.
I've also written a very funny piece that's coming, I think, on Tuesday. I think it's funny about the way one of my books has been adapted into a rom-com, which is a rom-com play thing that's being staged in Scotland next week. So I've been having a lot of fun with that. Anyway, there you go.
There you go. All right, folks, don't forget, if you don't do so already, listen to the podcast. And I'm referring to the Dumbly Dumb podcast because I'm taking it as granted you listen to the Archers either live or in podcast format. Ta-ta for now.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.